Business Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, more comings and goings in the president's cabinet. His choice to fill the vacancy left by the ouster of VA Secretary Shulkin has taken himself out of the running. Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, the White House physician, withdrew from consideration for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs.
Well, it seemed that President Trump's choice to run the VA ran into opposition just about from the beginning, Mark. And we know what a huge organization the VA is. It serves the health needs of some 9 million Americans and employs 350,000 medical professionals. It's also a major training ground for many of the nation's healthcare providers. But both Democratic and Republican members of Congress had expressed concern over his seeming lack of experience required to run such a massive health agency of management experience, especially one that's also in transition as the VA is and has a lot of major projects going on.
You know, I think the only silver lining in this cloud was that the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee acts in a bipartisan way. Both are very focused in on making sure our veterans are well taken care of at the leadership level.
Well, serving the needs of the nation's military is a strategically complex task, as well as one that's medically challenging for a variety of reasons that are unique to the military experience. And that brings us to our guest today. Vice Admiral Raquel Bono is the director of the Defense Health Agency, or the DHA, which oversees the health needs of the nation's military, as well as their families. She has decades of experience from her days as a field surgeon during Desert Storm to now running this really quite massive organization.
The DHA is also undergoing an agency-wide transformation to a more unified digital platform designed to foster interoperability within the vast health system. Vice Admiral Bono will share some unique insights into the challenges of delivering quality care from the battlefield triage to recovering for wounded vets here at home, to promoting prevention and primary care for the entire population. Really looking forward to that conversation, Margaret.
Indeed we are. And Lori Robertson will check in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com or follow us on Twitter or iTunes.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Vice Admiral Raquel Bono of the Defense Health Agency in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Another health industry executive is being considered for a big job in the cabinet, the VA secretary post, after the administration's pick to replace David Shulkin. White House Dr. Ronnie Jackson took himself out of consideration after controversies came to light about his on-the-job behaviors and lack of experience in running a massive and complex agency like the VA. Ascension CEO Tony Tersini is considered a capable steward of a large health system, and while he doesn't hail from a military background, he's had significant experience working with the VA health system, partnering with the Veterans Choice Program, which was launched after long wait times came to light in 2014. There are several other reported names on the list. Acting VA Secretary Robert Wilkie, who has been praised as doing a, quote, good job by the president, also mentioned recent Cleveland Clinic CEO Toby Cosgrove, who helped turn Cleveland Clinic into a global health entity. Another name on the list, former Florida Congressman Jeff Miller, now a lobbyist in Washington, who formerly served on the Veterans Affairs Committee. And Fox News contributor and Iraq War veteran Pete Hegseth is another name being mentioned. The 37-year-old conservative considered controversial pick within the veterans community, having come up against Secretary Shulkin, who was against the privatization of the VA health system, a $200 billion agency that treats some 9 million American veterans. Meanwhile, some good news. A recently released RAND Corporation study has shown the VA outperforms many other hospitals and health agencies in terms of outcomes. The study commissioned by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs found that overall performance at the VA was on par with or better than other health systems, with one consideration: there was a wide variation on access to care at different facilities around the country. The RAND study found the VA performed significantly better than non-VA hospitals on a number of measures, such as mortality and effectiveness of treatment. However, they did more poorly on readmissions. And for some soldiers, insomnia can be an issue. A study of 150 active duty soldiers at Fort Hood were able to improve their condition with talk therapy methods given over a short period of time. The soldiers were given a number of 60-minute sessions that taught them relaxation techniques and sleep hygiene. Short-term therapy interventions seemed to work. The soldiers who completed the so-called CBTI therapy interventions reported better sleep overall, fewer bouts of wakefulness, and there was an added benefit. Those soldiers also fared better on mental health tests, such as mental fatigue and mental wellness. An estimated 20% of enlisted soldiers, especially those who've been deployed in the past, are wrestling with insomnia issues. The study's lead author is suggesting this training should be provided on a much broader scale to address the health issue, which can also be a red flag for other mental health concerns among the nation's military. I'm Arianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Vice Admiral Raquel Bono, Director of the Defense Health Agency, the DHA. She leads a joint integrated combat support agency providing medical services to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. The DHA directs the 10 joint shared services, including TRICARE, the military health plan. Admiral Bono began field duty as a sergeant in 1990 during Operation Desert Storm and has since earned numerous distinctions, including the Defense Superior Service Medal and the Legion of Merit Medal. Admiral Bono served as the 11th Chief of the Navy Medical Corps. She also served as Command Surgeon for U.S. Pacific Command. She earned her medical degree from Texas Tech University, completing her general surgery residency at the Naval Medical Center. Admiral Bono, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you're at the helm of one of the largest and perhaps most complex health systems in the world. The Defense Health Agency covers millions of active, enlisted, and deployed members of all of the branches of the armed forces around the world, as well as the healthcare needs of their families. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners the greater challenges that you face at DHA, especially in terms of supporting a culture of collaboration, integration, to service such an enormous healthcare delivery system.
Mark, actually, you did a really nice job of describing it right there for everybody. But I think that what's an important part about being at the Defense Health Agency and some of the work that we're doing is to also understand that we are actually a microcosm of the larger healthcare environment. And so many of the challenges that you're seeing in the national healthcare are very similar to some of the challenges that we see in the military health system. But to your point, we are like the seventh largest healthcare system, one of the larger federated healthcare systems. And what you've got there are 9.4 million beneficiaries who need to receive care in a variety of settings, whether that's across the United States or overseas in international areas where we have some of the members of our military forward deployed. And certainly the thing that people most readily associate with the military health system is when we're on the combat field taking care of those that may be in harm's way. So just that alone gives you kind of an understanding of the scope and the type of patients that we might be serving. But even in those very unique settings, the challenges and the opportunities and the desire that we have for our beneficiaries is very similar to what we're trying to accomplish in the healthcare for our nation.
Well, Admiral Bono, we've seen much military engagement in recent years. Your agency has to ensure that members of the military have access to really sophisticated and quality care in the war theater and in some pretty remote and inhospitable regions of the world. So maybe you could share with our listeners a little more about what are these unique challenges of delivering healthcare in a hostile and unpredictable environment. And I am betting that there have been some real innovations and maybe some breakthroughs that the Defense Health Agency has created to address these challenges.
Absolutely. If I could first address what we do when we have people who are actually forward deployed, and in some cases in international settings where they also are allowed to bring some of their family members.
Right.
These would be places like, you know, in Italy and in Germany. And part of what we're able to do there is we do very extensive partnering with not only our partners with the international SOS, but also partnering with the local healthcare that they have in the area. And in many of these overseas areas, the healthcare that is available there is very comparable to Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
When we get to the more austere environments where we're forward deployed and we're in a contingency setting or a combat setting, you're absolutely right. we're working in a much more austere environment where we adhere to the principles of resuscitation and treatment that are common across any of the emergency areas in the United States and in the emergency departments. But it does require us to have a certain level of innovation, and several things have come out of this last conflict where we have looked at the use of tourniquets and how effectively we now use them in a situation where you have significant hemorrhage. Mm-hmm. You may also see that we have partnered, the military has partnered with the American College of Surgeons to the Stop Bleed campaign.
Right. I've been reading about that.
Yes. And so this is very exciting because, for a while there, tourniquets had fallen out of favor.
Right.
But because of the experience, the successful experience that we've had on the battlefield, we were able to come back and everybody's been able to relook now at the use of tourniquets, recognizing that they can be used in a very effective and safe way. So I think that's an example of where in a very austere and hostile environment, we've kind of re-innovated the use of the tourniquet mm-hmm. and been able to inform how that would make a very positive impact on civilian emergency care.
And it really has made an enormous impact on the civilian population. And, Admiral, you were appointed to your current post under President Obama. It was with a clear mission in mind to oversee the transformation of the Defense Health Agency to become more streamlined, responsive, efficient, and hopefully elegant, as we'd like to say. And the DHA is in a period of profound change management, including the deployment of a new electronic health record system. And for all of those who listen who know, that is a challenge in any organization across your system. I can't imagine how you sleep at night. But tell us about the new EHR system you're adopting and the operational changes required for its implementation. And what other systems are you targeting to help streamline the care delivery process at DHA?
Well, I think that this is an important advancement for the military health system. And it is something, too, that we realized that there are more elegant solution sets that are out there in the commercial sector. And the Defense Health Agency is looking to optimize those connections that we have with industry to say, what are some of the solution sets that you're using, and is that something that we can deploy within our military health system? So this is a commercial off-the-shelf program, and we brought that in, and we wanted to bring that in for a variety of reasons, because we recognize that with technology moving as quickly as it's moving, that we needed to be able to have access to the leading edge that industry offers and continue to get the upgrades as they were created. So going with a commercial off-the-shelf product was an extremely important part for us in the military health system. Now, as you rightly pointed out, that is a significant change management effort. And I think for the military health system, what makes this something that is a driven change, and it's driven from within the military health system, is that we all share the same goal, making sure that we're taking care of our patients, no matter if they're Army, Air Force, and Navy, and no matter where they are, whether they're here in garrison or whether they're deployed to the battlefield. And so with our new electronic health record, it allows us to maintain access to our patients' data no matter where they may be transferred, because one of the unique things about our patient population, our military, is that every couple of years we move to different duty stations. So having this electronic health record system that can be accessed no matter where our patients are is very attractive, and I think is a strong enabler to making sure that we're providing that continuity of care and we're getting that most transparency of our patient data.
Well, Admiral Bono, part of the mission at the Defense Health Agency is to create a medically ready health professional workforce. And I can tell you, training the next generation of healthcare providers and professionals is always on our minds. But you've got some very specialized healthcare workforce needs, preparing your frontline trauma physicians and surgeons and nurses for care delivery in the conflict zones, and also the care that goes on afterwards for those who've been wounded in battle. And you've also got primary care. We've learned a lot about the Veteran Affairs Health Professional Education and Training System, but I don't think we are well-versed in the work that you are doing. So tell us about the infrastructure that supports the education and training of your clinical workforce to meet such a broad spectrum of needs.
You're right. There's a broad spectrum that we need to be paying attention to. And in having the medically ready force and a ready medical force, there are different drivers for how we go about doing that. Let me talk a little bit about the medically ready force. Those are the folks in that provide the health care, that deploy with our operational troops to make sure that they are well cared for and that they have the medical support once needed in these different contingency environments. So those that are what we think of as more combat-oriented, things like surgery, anesthesia, emergency medicine, those types of specialties that have a lot of trauma-related capability. So being able to make sure that we provide the right kind of training, that we have the providers who are ready to go at a moment's notice is an imperative. What people don't oftentimes see is that we have a very strong reliance on our medical enlisted, who oftentimes do the immediate and the initial resuscitation for anybody who's injured. For our medical enlisted, we have something called the Medical Education Training Campus in San Antonio, METSI, where for all the medical enlisted across Army, Air Force, Navy, we're able to train them to a standardized level of how you do these type of trauma resuscitation. And that's something I think you see reflected in the survivability rate that we had in the last 15 years. Our corpsmen, our medics, and our med techs are the first responders, and because of the training and the standardized training they have, we were able to have a very high rate of survivability, up in the 90s, 90-plus percent. And I think that's a direct reflection of that training that we provided to all of our medical enlisted. For our surgeons, anesthesiologists, for the specialty care, at trauma care, we not only provide those opportunities within our direct care system, our military treatment facilities, we also partner with civilian institutions, with trauma centers. And the great examples of that is some of the response that we've been able to participate in with our civilian partners. The Pacific Northwest, with the railroad that went off there.
Oh, yes.
So some of our providers in Madigan were able to help the local trauma.
Yeah, that's great. That.
In Las Vegas, with the terrible episode there, some of our military surgeons participated with the civilians in taking care of those victims. And then, you know, another example is in San Antonio, where we have the only level one trauma center for the Department of Defense. Partnering with University Hospital enabled them to be able to be part of the response to those Sutherland Spring mass casualties.
We're speaking today with Vice Admiral Raquel Bono, Director of the Defense Health Agency, the DHA. She leads a joint integrated combat support agency providing medical services to the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. Admiral, you know, in thinking about this show, we need to say, confess our ignorance. We wanted to really educate more people about the great work that happens at DHA. I think most of our listeners are probably more well-versed in the Veterans Health Administration. I wanted to know what the integration was. How's the handoff go so that our audience might understand this continuum of care to our military service members?
We know that the most vulnerable time in anybody's healthcare experience is when there is a handoff of some kind, even if it's something as simple as going from the emergency department to another part of the hospital. And for us in the military system, where we take care of our active duty who are in uniform and their family members, we recognize that our partnership with the VA and the helps with the transition for all of our members as they go from the care that they receive in the DOD to the care that they receive in the veterans' hospitals. So what we try to do then is optimize our partnering with the VA, and how we're going about doing that is with the electronic health record. We know that there's a lot of information sharing that needs to occur as a patient transitions their care from one sector to another. And so we want to be able to have as much transparency and interoperability of that data transfer with the VA. And you may have heard that VA is also very interested in using the same electronic health record that we're deploying, and we're working very closely with the VA to understand how that may be optimized. It's a very exciting opportunity here. I think the other thing that we're looking at is how well can we partner with each other in certain locations where we have a strong military presence and we also have a strong VA presence. Are there ways that we can be doing more resource sharing to include facilities, personnel, like nurses, doctors, surgeons, and then other services? So we're actively looking for those types of opportunities. And I think you're also seeing this in the civilian healthcare market, is that there's more and more partnering and collaboration
going on
because the ability of any one system to provide all services is getting more and more challenging to do. And the best way to do that is to find ways to partner. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes partnering with the VA a natural fit.
You know, Dr. Bono, I think another area that must be a front of mind, very shared concern with you and the leaders in Veteran Affairs is the invisible trauma. You've done such an amazing job of saving lives on the battlefield and helping people recover. But trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder is such a concern for everybody. I know former First and Second Ladies Michelle Obama and Jill Biden launched the Joining Forces campaign a few years ago to help really just sort of mobilize the country's efforts and highlight, if you could, some of the promising research that has emerged. And how is that research now helping soldiers and their families deal with PTSD? Are we making some progress on that front?
Margaret, I think we absolutely are, but I think that all of us collectively have come to appreciate how complex this actually is. And because it's so complex, the solution set is not a one-size-fits-all. And there has to be a high degree of individualized treatment and a high degree of appreciation for how each individual is affected by trauma and how they respond to it in very unique ways. The best approach to this is taking a multidisciplinary approach and a multimodality approach, making sure that in all that treatment that the support network, the family or the extended family of the individual is included as part of that. Mm-hmm. I can't stress how much we've realized that makes such an impact. And so as we're continuing our work on this, that multimodality approach is the preferred way to do this, that we design our systems to make sure that we have that multimodality approach. And we also realize that the network needs to be a part of that, to include that in some cases the family and that network also need some assistance and support with any behavioral health repercussions. Mm-hmm. We have tremendous support from a lot of people in industry and in private organizations who are very helpful in making sure that we can keep our military members and their families at the forefront of this.
And Admiral, thinking about things that you keep in the forefront, you've been very focused in on how we build a better 21st century healthcare system. Today, you've used the word partnering in teams a lot. You have to do that with not only within the various branches of the military, but also across many of our NATO allies who partner with the Defense Health Agency to provide care around the globe. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners, what have you learned that might be helpful for us to emulate in the broader healthcare system in America?
It is so true. We partner with our international partners and allies, and because we oftentimes serve together in the battlefield or in a contingency operation, we're oftentimes taking care of each other's members, each other's patients. And so being able to have that interoperability either in our equipment, our devices, our processes, our health record only serves to enhance and support that ability to care for people in a very very rapid way, but also make sure that we're keeping the transitions as tight and as informed as possible. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that not only do we continue to work with them and participate in training evolutions, where we have these military training, we always make sure that we're doing some type of medical training as well with our partners. And what I've done here in the Defense Health Agency is actually invited representatives from Germany, Canada, and the UK to sit here in the Defense Health Agency and to be a part of our conversations so that we have access to some of the things that they're thinking, and they actually can participate in helping to shape and inform our thinking of where we'd like to go with our next efforts.
We've been speaking today with Vice Admiral Raquel Bono, the Director of the Defense Health Agency. You can learn more about their work by going to health.mil/DHA, or you can follow Dr. Bono on Twitter at DHA Director. Vice Admiral, thank you so much for your dedication, for your service to the country, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and I really appreciate your interest.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Many readers have asked us whether people have developed cancer because they received the polio vaccine. There are no known cases, and it's very unlikely. In the 1950s and 1960s, people did receive polio vaccines that were contaminated with a virus that causes cancer in rodents. But research suggests this virus doesn't cause cancer in humans. About 1 in 200 people who contract the polio virus develop polio, which involves loss of movement in the limbs. In 1954, the year before the polio vaccine became widely available, the U.S. saw more than 18,000 reported cases of paralytic polio, according to the CDC. By 1964, that number had dropped to 106. While the U.S. is virtually polio-free now, the disease still is present in other parts of the world, so the CDC still recommends that children get the vaccine. The vaccine's developer, Jonas Salk, grew the polio virus in a culture of monkey kidney cells and then used a chemical called formalin to kill the virus, rendering it unable to cause polio. Like other vaccines, this dead virus teaches people's immune systems how to build up defenses against the virus. In 1960, scientists discovered that some of the monkey kidney cells used to make the polio vaccine were contaminated with simian virus 40. For monkeys, this virus is harmless, but in high doses, SV40 can cause cancer in rodents. Starting in 1961, authorities required new lots of polio vaccines to be free of SV40. Still, many vaccines produced prior to this year weren't recalled. The number of people truly at risk, those exposed to live SV40, remains unknown. Even among the contaminated vaccines, the formalin used to kill the polio virus killed all or most of the SV40 as well, according to a 2006 review of the issue published in the International Journal of Cancer. In 2002, a committee at the National Academies Institute of Medicine found, quote, that the evidence was inadequate to conclude whether or not the contaminated polio vaccine caused cancer. Why? Well, studies have consistently shown that people who received the polio vaccine in the 1950s and 1960s had no increased risk of cancer. But that doesn't rule out the possibility that some select individuals could have developed cancer. While studies have shown the SV40 virus can cause cancer in rodents, that doesn't mean it can cause cancer in humans. The National Academies report didn't find conclusive evidence for a causal link between the contaminated vaccines and cancer, and research published since has only moved the scientific pendulum toward a lack of a causal link. So while some vaccines were contaminated several decades ago, it's very unlikely they caused anyone to develop cancer. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. September is Suicide Prevention Month, and it's of particular interest to the Veterans Administration. An estimated 22 veterans per day are taking their own lives in what's being described as a post-war suicide crisis. With a lack of behavioral health clinicians available for every veteran who's experiencing difficulty, the VA has launched a campaign aimed at all Americans who know veterans who may be struggling to be aware that they can make a difference just by reaching out. It's called the Power of One campaign, the idea that one person reaching out to one veteran in a caring manner can make a difference.
The power of one small action, one conversation, or one phone call can make a difference in the life of a veteran going through a difficult time. For free 24/7 confidential support, call the Veterans Crisis Line or the Military.
According to Dr. Caitlin Thompson, Deputy Director of VA's Suicide Prevention Program, it takes only a moment and just one small act can start them down the path to getting the support they need. The VA has launched a suicide prevention hotline. It's now collaborating with community groups across the country to prepare them to better address the needs of these veterans, many of whom don't know how to ask for the help they need. Veterans, service members, and anyone concerned about them can call the Veterans Crisis Line, 1-800-273-8255. They can chat online at veteranscrisisline.net/chat or send a text to 838-255. even if they're not registered with the VA or enrolled in VA healthcare. All Veterans Crisis Line resources are optimized for mobile devices. A dedicated program aimed at reaching out to veterans across the country, empowering community groups and individuals to find ways of offering support to getting veterans the help they need before it's too late. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.